Okay, we are continuing our study of the last week in the life of Christ before his crucifixion. And we are in Matthew 22. And I like to try, I'm trying for us to get the feeling of what it was like for Jesus as he went through these days. And especially the human side of him. Obviously he was divine, but he had a human side also, which I think made these days very anxious for him. In Matthew 22, the first 14 verses are the parable of the wedding feast. And this is very interesting. Most scholars think, but they don't know, they think that we're probably on Tuesday before the crucifixion. We really don't know that, and there's no way to tell how it was. I look in some of my Bibles, and it has the last days of Christ's life, and it tells you what happened on every day. And they don't know. They're making guesses, and they might be right or wrong. I guess this is either Monday or Tuesday, and if I had to speculate, I'd guess it's Tuesday. This parable is very interesting for several reasons. The ones that we've looked at so far, and some more that we'll look at in this chapter, had an audience, and we knew how the audience reacted. In this one, we don't know who the audience is. There is an audience, I think. If you say, well, it looks like it's a continuation of what was going on in chapter 21, where he had it out with the Jewish leaders and made them mad. And maybe that's the case. And also, the way it starts, it says, and Jesus answered and spoke to them. So clearly somebody said something to which Jesus responded, only we don't know who that was. So it's possible it was more for the Pharisees and the Jewish leaders. Again, I don't know. But it's interesting to me that Matthew doesn't tell us who reacted and how they reacted. So what that leads me to conclude is Matthew, through the Holy Spirit, must have written this for the readers, which is us. So we must need to be getting something out of this. Also, this parable is interesting because Jesus doesn't explain it. And also Matthew doesn't explain it. You know, Matthew explains some things. This happened because it was to fulfill prophecy and et cetera. And sometimes Jesus, they say, well, what does this mean? And he tells the disciples, well, it means this. And you know, the prophecy, the parable took 12 verses and the explanation took 10 verses. And he explains it to them, but he doesn't explain it to us. And then also Matthew is the only one that has this parable. Mark, Luke, and John don't have it in there. So it's also interesting for another reason, as I've looked at this thing. This parable is not only historic, but it's also prophetic. The first 6 verses of it have to do with the past. The next about 7 verses have to do with prophecy about what's going to happen in the future being from that time, and also the future for us as we look at it. And then in verse 14, I don't know what, did I do something wrong? In verse 14, he gives a concluding lesson. Now the lesson, obviously, is supposed to go with the parable. So it's up to us to figure that out. Now since he doesn't explain it, and since Matthew doesn't explain it, then it's up to us to figure out what it means. And I think, based on what we know about past history and the scriptures, that with 95% confidence, we can figure out what this parable means, I think. So, as I've done in the past, what I'm going to try to do is explain what each verse means so that we don't have to go through, first of all, and read what the verses are, and then go through what each one represented. I think it's more efficient just to try to figure it out. And if anybody disagrees with me, then go in the other class. No, if anybody disagrees with me, I'd be glad to hear what your disagreement is and why. And if you have a question, obviously, I'm very open to hearing your questions and your comments about anything. Okay, so let's look at the first 6 verses, which in my view have to do with history. And it's a familiar history, which Jesus has made over and over and over again, trying to convince the thick-headed Jews to do the right thing. And, you know, it's interesting that we think about Jesus was the Son of God, and yet he was very unsuccessful in convincing the Jews to do the right thing. That's interesting. It ought to make us feel not so bad if we're trying to talk with somebody about the gospel and they don't obey it, and they say, ah, it's all nonsense, and I don't want to talk about it anymore. Well, Jesus had the same experience many times. Okay, verse 1. And Jesus answered and spoke to them again in parables, saying, them. And we don't know who the them is, but he spoke to them in parables. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to a king who gave a wedding feast for his son. Okay, the king who gave the feast is God the Father. The son is obviously Jesus. And the kingdom is the kingdom of God. And then the wedding feast and participating in the wedding is experiencing all the benefits that come from being in the kingdom. Or now for the Jews, it was physically being in the kingdom of Israel. But we also know about spiritual Israel. So there's that, and I think the application is to both. Verse 3, and he sent out his slaves, who I believe were the prophets, to call those who had been invited to the wedding feast, and they were unwilling to come. Now, the interesting thing about this is not everyone was invited to the feast yet. He sent his slaves, the prophets, to call those who had been invited. Well, who were the select group of people that were invited to be God's kingdom? Well, obviously, it was the Jews, Israel. He invited them to the wedding feast to experience the benefits of being in God's kingdom, and they were unwilling to come. Well, the Jews rejected him. 4, again, he sent out other slaves, more prophets. Tell those who have been invited, behold, I have prepared my dinner, my oxen, my fattened livestock, all are butchered. Everything is ready. Come to the wedding feast. And it reminds me of a song I've sung since I was 6. All things are ready. Come to the feast. We don't sing that one anymore, I guess. Too old. Too many people know it. Anyway, but Jesus is, I mean, the king here is saying, I've prepared all of this and gone to all this trouble. So let me send some more prophets and try to persuade you all to come, you invited guests. In verse 6, but they paid no attention and went their way. One to his own farm or his land, and another to his business. They had better things to do, they thought. Now keep in mind, we don't live in a kingdom, but if a king invited you to the wedding for his son, wouldn't that be a big deal? I mean, I think it'd be a very big deal. And yet they casually rejected the offer. And the rest seized his slaves and mistreated and killed them. So that's talking about the Jews, mostly the Jewish leaders, who were behind killing the prophets, not even obeying them or even tolerating listening to them, but killing them. We know that that happened. Mistreated them and killed them. Okay, now that's history. And Jesus has gone through this history, sometimes realistically and sometimes through parables, several times with the Jewish leaders trying to get them to come to their senses. Now look at verse 7. In verse 7, I think we start the prophecy part of this parable. But the king was enraged. Well, that's something. Think about that. The king, you live in a kingdom, and there is a king who is all-powerful, and what you have done is not just irritate him or make him mad, you have enraged him. And if the king is God the Father, think about God the Father in rage, and I don't want to be the recipient of what he does while he is enraged. But the king was enraged and sent his armies and destroyed those murderers and set their city on fire. Now this is where I told you I have 95% confidence on this, that this is correct. But I think one of the most misunderstood things that happened in the Bible and in history was the destruction of Jerusalem. So we're talking somewhere around between 30 and 33 AD when Jesus is going through all this. And only 40 years later, 37 years later, whatever it might be there, the Roman army surrounded Jerusalem and absolutely destroyed it, burned it to the ground, and destroyed the temple. And I think what Jesus is doing here is he is prophesying about that. And they had no clue this was going to happen. And, of course, in Matthew 24, he goes into huge detail about how that is going to happen. It was a really bloody, messy massacre that happened. And hundreds of thousands of Jews were killed, and the city was destroyed. 8, then he said to his slaves, the wedding is ready, It's still ready. The people we invited chose not to come, and I destroyed them, and I burnt down their city. The wedding is ready, but those who were invited were not worthy. Okay, now a question for you. Why were they not worthy? Were they not worthy because the king had decided ahead of time they were not worthy? Or were they not worthy because of their actions?
Their actions.
Yes. And I think that's an important point to realize. And we're going to see that Jesus makes that point again near the end of this. They were not worthy because of what they did and chose to reject the invitation. But the invitation, the feast was prepared, and they were given a specific invitation, which was kind of an elitist invitation. It wasn't for everybody. It was just for them. And they said no. And now the king says they were not worthy. Well, that's not predestination. They were invited, but they declined. So they were not worthy because of what they did. The responsibility is with the human. It's not with God. 9. So he says, go therefore to the main highways, add as many as you find there, and as many as you find there, invite to the wedding feast. So they went out into the streets, and they gathered together all they found, both evil and good. I find that interesting. And the wedding hall was filled with dinner guests. So now the invitation is open, not to a select few, but to everybody. And he says, go out to all the highways, find everybody you can, invite them. And so lots of people started showing up, good and bad, showing up. Now, what would that be? Who would the slaves be there? Well, it'd be the apostles who are going out now and inviting the hated Gentiles to become Christians and to come into God's kingdom. And anybody who wants to, whosoever will may come, as the song says. So I think that's where we're getting into the prophetic part of this parable. Now, verse 11 indicates that there were some expectations that went along with being invited to this wedding. And apparently people were expected to know what the expectations were. One of the expectations was attire. You were supposed to dress a certain way. How are they supposed to know how to do that? Well, chances are it was very common knowledge when you go to a big-time wedding. You know, if somebody says you're getting invited to a formal wedding, you know, the women wear a very expensive dress to the gown, to the floor, and the men wear maybe a tuxedo or what have you. And everybody knows this is a big deal. It's a posh affair. And they were supposed to know that. Here. But there's a moment of reckoning. The king now comes into the banquet hall. When the king came in to look over the dinner guests, he saw there a man not dressed in wedding clothes. And the guy stood out because he was not conforming to the expectations for going to an affair like this. And the king says to him, friend, how did you come in here without wedding clothes? And he was speechless. Now, I think what we're getting down to is the part that really applies to us now. But obviously, the king expected the people who showed up at the feast to fulfill some expectations. And the one they pick out for us here in the parable that Jesus picks out for us is one of the most obvious ones: you dress appropriately. This guy was not dressed appropriately, and the king called him out for it, probably embarrassed him in front of everybody else. And he says, how'd you come in here without wedding clothes? And notice that the reaction of the guy who came in not dressed appropriately, he was speechless. Now, for those of you who are parents and your kids were little and you caught them doing something they absolutely knew they were not supposed to do, and you sit them down for the parent-child talk and you say, why did you do such a thing? And has your child ever looked back at you speechless? Why is that? Well, because he knows he's guilty. Anything you say, kid, can be used against you. Are you going to lie to me? Are you going to confess? Why are you going to give me an excuse why you did that? I mean, this guy couldn't say, well, I didn't know. He had to be able to know, because if you're sitting there and everybody else is dressed in formal wear and you're not, You know, you think, well, I'm out of place here. I might need to go change and come back. Or maybe he didn't care. Or maybe he said, I don't agree with that policy. I don't know what the reasons were. Jesus doesn't tell us. But for whatever it was, he didn't. Now, verse 13. The king said to the servants, bind him hand and foot, cast him into the outer darkness. In that place there should be weeping and gnashing of teeth. That's pretty heavy consequences for a guy that didn't wear a tuxedo to the feast, isn't it? I don't know how you all feel about being tied up. I see these TV shows where they go arrest somebody and they put their hands behind their back, put the cuffs on them. You know, if they did that to me, they might as well just go ahead and shoot me, because I can't handle that. So think of that. Jesus is seriously projecting an image here of misery, and he says, first of all, bind their hands. Right, then bind their feet so they can't walk, they can't get away. Now throw them into outer darkness. Now, can you imagine that? Can you think of it? I can't even go into one of these. What's this machine with the tube in it? And you go in and take your picture. What is that thing? It's a CAT scan, isn't it? MRI, yeah, whatever. You know, I got to take a pill before I go in there. And I always ask them before I go in there, will my head still be out? And they say, yes, crazy, it will be, you know. And then I say, have you ever had people like me before? And they said, yes, all the time. Well, craziness loves company. So, but anyway, the thought of having my hands tied and my feet tied and being thrown into darkness makes me shiver. And it says, it is so miserable, there'll be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Sheer misery. Well, there's only one way to interpret that, and that's hell. I don't know how else you can, what if the guess makes sense? I don't know. If somebody has one, I'll be glad to hear it. All right, and then Jesus says, for many are called, but few are chosen. Okay, now let me just ask you this question. We talked about the guests who rejected the invitation and were not worthy because of their own choice. Now in verse 14, you've heard this many times. Many are called, few are chosen. I've heard that all my life. When it says few are chosen, is that predestination? You're saying no? Why not?
Because they were all invited. The guests themselves decided if they would be chosen or not.
Many are called. Few are chosen. Reminds me a whole lot of what Jesus said in Matthew 7. About broad ways and narrow ways. Yeah. Now, why were they not chosen? Did they have the opportunity to be chosen? Of course they did. Had they conformed to the expectations, the rules for being a part of this dinner, in other words, enjoying the benefits of the kingdom, they would have been chosen. But they were not chosen because of their own actions. It is not predestination. He said, many are called, but few are chosen. Why is that? Because they choose not to be chosen. And I think that's for us. Any comments or questions about this and the application for us? Jimmy?
I know you mentioned, obviously, it's only recorded in Matthew, but I couldn't help but think over in Luke chapter 12, we've got this idea of a wedding feast again. Luke 12, verse 35, be dressed in readiness. Ready or not, you know, you've been called, yeah. Been invited, and even the one that's given this example seems like, yeah, I'm willing, but shows up not really ready. So this idea of being ready to be part of this chosen too, you know, you've been called. Are you ready to be selected? Are you ready to be selected?
How does that apply to us?
Well, it's the same thing.
How can we be among those who are called but not chosen? I think that's right. To me, this is a very sobering parable. You know, you think, well, the guy didn't wear the right clothes. Big deal. Whoa, look at the penalty for that. It is a big deal. And then you go through, what are the possible reasons? What was this guy thinking about why he didn't choose to do the right thing? I don't know what his excuses were. Were they any good? No. So what are our excuses? Are they any good? No. Has human nature changed in the last 2,000 years? Absolutely not. We're just like these people. Only I hope we make better choices.
I was going to say the other thing. I know it doesn't say it here, but when I read this idea of many, for many are called, but few are chosen, we could just easily say, for many are called and many could be chosen.
Yes.
You know, I mean,
they could be chosen if they decided to follow the rules. Yeah, and the parable you mentioned is kind of a combination. It also throws in the people with the lamps, the virgins with the lamps, that sort of thing.
Bob, I got a question. Why do you think it reads many are called, but few are chosen instead of few choose? Because it seems like it's a choice on our part if we're going to be chosen. You know what I mean? Like it's the chosen is like God chooses you.
Yes. Well, who was allowed? I'm having trouble explaining this, and I have a very profound thought, but it's so profound I can't explain it.
The way that it's profound, I look at that is it's the image of authority. So you have a teacher of a class come in, or a director of a company, and he's going to choose those who are hired for the positions. Now he's going to choose those who are qualified. Now, all of them were called, but he chose few. Why did he only choose few? Because only few were qualified.
Yeah.
If every single person in there was qualified, he would have taken them all. And so I think the image here is God's in authority. He's calling everybody. But unfortunately, he's only going to choose few because the others are not ready.
Yeah. Well, that's very good. That's better than what I was going to say. I was going to try to fall back into the parable itself. Did the king choose who got to stay in the wedding feast? Well, the answer is yes, he did. So he called people and he chose people. Now, people who he chose were the ones he allowed to stay. The people who were not chosen were the ones that did not conform to the expectations, and they were kicked out. So in a sense, God is doing the choosing, but we determine whether or not we get chosen. Does that make sense? Yeah, anybody else want to jump in on that? Yeah, John.
Bob, when our readings in John talking about the parable of the good shepherd, Jesus says that the shepherd goes to the sheepfold. He calls the sheep. His sheep follow him. And so I think that's where the call is out there, but only the people who want to follow are the ones who will be chosen. They're following. They're coming to the voice that calls them.
Yeah. Yeah. Thought I saw another hand over there.
I was thinking of Taylor's point. Ephesians 4 has some of that same language where we sometimes, and some people look at it and go, you know, it's God doing the choosing. We don't have anything to do with it. In Ephesians chapter 1, verse 4, just as he chose us in him before the foundation of the world, in verse 5, he predestined us to adoption. So if you read that just casually, it sounds like, well, we didn't have anything to do with it. But it's
no, but we had everything to do with it.
It's back to his authority, right? He's decided this is how it works, and he's given us the opportunity to work within that framework for it to work for us.
Yeah.
But just as he makes the invitation, we've got to accept it.
Well, and in this parable, Jimmy, just along with what you said, look again at verse 4. The king says, tell those who've been involved, I prepared my dinner. My oxen, my fattened livestock are all butchered. Everything is ready. Come to the feast. Well, he says the same thing spiritually to us today. He's done his part. What more could he do besides send his son down here to die and take our place on the cross? And then we're going to say, I don't like your rules? Really? I like the rules. I don't want to have my hands and feet bound and go into eternal darkness. Anybody else have a comment about this? Okay. Oh.
The
Okay, and the interesting thing about the example you just gave was you chose to go to the wedding, but they chose to invite you. So it's a mutual choosing. God is saying, I'm inviting you. Now you choose whether or not to come. Yeah, we could speculate about the good and the bad. I'm not sure what that involves. It could be that some of the bad people decided, hey, I'm not dressed for this. I think I'll go get dressed for it and come and honor the expectations. And it could be that some of the other bad people said, I'm not going to mess with this. And maybe this guy who came dressed shabbily or inappropriately was one of the bad people. And what he chose to do indicated why he was classed with the bad ones. I don't like this idea. I don't think I should get dressed up for this stupid wedding. Whatever else his excuse might be. Anybody else? Yes.
One more thing, maybe being a dead horse here, but I just think about this kind of the categories of people in that group that are called, and really it's just this kind of faceless population. It's just...
It's everybody. Absolutely.
Maybe it's helpful in this idea about the kind of the choosing on both sides.
Yeah.
And, I think about in John when people talk about that, you know, the sheep and the shepherd, the calling, the drawing power of the Father and all that. In John 12, it says, if I'm lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto me. That drawing power is to the masses.
Yeah. I think we could split this up several ways, and that's a really good one. To look at it. Anybody else? Okay, now we have three groups here in this chapter who come and take a crack at Jesus. It's very interesting, three groups. And after the third one, it says they don't come and mess with him anymore, which is really interesting. And to try to get across to you what these people are trying to do, let me tell you something that happened to me probably 20 years ago. I was teaching this class over at Auburn. It was a graduate class, but it was an intro class. It was really basic stuff. It met one night a week. And the students were supposed to read a chapter as they came to each class. And I know most of them did read a chapter. You never read the chapter. You wait until before the test and stay up all night. I know that. But anyway, I pretended they all read it. So at the beginning of each class, I would say, I'm sure you all have read the chapter. Is there anything in there you didn't understand or want me to explain? If there is, raise your hand. Well, nobody ever raised their hand because he hadn't read the chapter. I knew that. But there was one guy who drove over from Montgomery for the class. And keep in mind, it's a basic intro class, which I had taught 25 times. So I knew it front and back of this information. Anyway, this guy would raise his hand, and he had this little smirk on his face. And I thought, oh, this is nice. Somebody read the chapter and they actually have a question. He'd asked me this off-the-wall question that I guess technically had something to do with the chapter, but it was way out. And so I would answer his question. I thought, well, this guy's just a creative thinker. I'll answer his question. Well, the second class shows up next week. Any questions? This guy raises him that same little smirk. And he asked me another off-the-wall question. And this time, students are looking at him, you know, that look where, would you please shut up? You know, he couldn't see it, but I could see it. And so, third week, same thing, same smirk. And finally, I realized none of these questions are sincere. So, in about week six, anybody have any questions? He gets that same stupid little smirk. And I always ask him after I said it, did I explain that to your satisfaction? And I always did. Yeah, you did. But he was never excited. Well, about the sixth week, he raised his hand again. And so finally I said, Mr. So-and-so, I'm going to answer your question. I have answered all your other questions, and I'm going to answer this one. But I want you to know that what you're doing is playing a game. It's called Stump the Professor. And you're trying to see if you can ask me a question that I can't answer. Now, why you're doing that, I don't know. Are you trying to make me look bad? Are you trying to make yourself look good? You're trying to embarrass me in front of everybody else? I don't know why you're doing it, but I just want you to know that I know. Now, here's the answer to your question. And so, you know what? He didn't ask me any more questions. And I thought, man, I wish I'd done this 3 weeks ago. Okay, so that's what's going on here, except Jesus is not me. This guy was asking a question to somebody who knew a whole lot about a very simple slice of material, special education for children with disabilities. I was really good in that. But Jesus, the Son of God, knew everything about everything, including he knew what was in their hearts. And he instantly knew when they were asking questions that were not sincere. And he gave perfect answers. I didn't give perfect answers. I mean, I gave an answer. I think I answered the question, but I'd stop way short of saying it was perfect. So the stakes are a whole lot higher in what's going on here. This is some little jerk from Montgomery who's asking some human some questions he doesn't think he can answer. Here we got spiritual leaders asking the Son of God, the Messiah himself, questions trying to make him look bad. Really dumb. And it was really an unfair battle. You know, somebody told me one time they refused to have a battle of wits with somebody who was unarmed. And that's what was going on here. Jesus knew all of it, and they knew nothing of it. And he made fools out of them. Well, let's look at, what do we want to look at here? We want to look at 15 through 22, I think. Okay, then the Pharisees went. Now, did this happen right after he gave this parable about the wedding feast? I don't know. But it does say then, but I don't know how much time passed. Then the Pharisees went and counseled together how they might trap him in what he said. Now, right there, that tells you exactly what their purpose was. Let's trap this guy. And they sent, now it's interesting here, they sent their disciples to him along with Herodians. Okay, who were the Herodians? Well, the Herodians were a bunch of Jews who were followers of Herod the Great, who was the Herod who was in power, the king of Judea, when Jesus was crucified. It was that Herod. Now, he had a bunch of descendants who were also called Herods. But the point is, this Herod and the Herodians were people who were very happy cooperating with Rome. Well, what did the typical Jew think about cooperating with Rome? They hated it. They hated Rome like crazy. And so what we have here, and it's interesting to me, it says the Pharisees sent their disciples. They didn't go in person. They sent their disciples. And they sent them with the Herodians. Now, how did the Herodians and the Pharisees get along? They hate each other's guts. But they were ready to agree to try to attack Jesus. One of them hated the Romans, and the other one said, we're fine with the Romans because we got political power with them. So that explains why they asked this question. I listened to the fake flattery that went on first of all. 16. They sent their disciples to him along with the Herodians, saying, teacher, we know that you are truthful and teach the way of God in truth and defer to no one, for you are not partial to any. Boy, how much money is that worth? Well, a negative amount. Phony praise. Tell us, therefore, what do you think? Is it lawful to give a poll tax to Caesar or not? Okay, now, why do they think that was such a clever question? Well, in the audience, there must have been a bunch of people around listening to this. And they think, we're giving him a question that he's going to lose either way he answers it. If he says, yeah, you need to pay the poll tax to Caesar, then most of the Jews are going to say, oh, we hate that. Because we hate Caesar. We hate Rome. And now he's a pro-Caesar kind of guy, and we can't stand that. And so it's going to diminish his popularity. What if he says not to do it? Well, what are the Herodians going to do? The Herodians are going to run and tell somebody, some Roman, somebody somewhere, that this guy says that you shouldn't pay taxes to Rome. And so that's going to be treason. So they think they've got him over a barrel. But Jesus perceived their malice, which is intense ill will to do evil. He perceived their malice, and he said, why are you testing me? You hypocrites, show me a coin. So they bring out a denarius. Show me the coin used for the poll tax. And they brought him a denarius, which is about what was given for a day's wage. And he said to them, whose likeness and inscription is this? Look at the coin. Whose picture's on there? Well, that's Caesar. And what's it say? Something about how wonderful Caesar is. And he said to them, whose likeness? Then they said to him, well, Caesar's. Then he said to them, then render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. Wow. And ring the bell. And render to God the things that are God's. How did he escape that trap? They thought, we've got him. If he says this one, he makes this group mad. If he says that one, we get him in trouble politically. And he says, well, give Caesar what he's due and give God what he's due. And hearing this, they marveled. And leaving him, they went away. Isn't that interesting? They thought they had him. Now, what we're going to see next week is that the Sadducees also think they've got him. But we're told enough about what the Sadducees believe. They didn't believe in a resurrection. So they're going to ask him a question about the resurrection. Man, we'll nail him on this one. This poor guy believes in the resurrection. So we'll ask him a question. He can't answer about the resurrection. And he makes fools of them too. We'll look at that next week. What thoughts, comments do you have? We only have 3 or 4 minutes here left. About what the disciples of the Pharisees and Herodians tried to pull on him and how you made him look like fools, John.
But you talked about earlier how Jesus says to explain the parable. Apparently he didn't need to, because it says then the Pharisees and the leaders started to conspire against him. They understood what he was saying and who he was talking about.
The evidence, I think, strongly suggests just what you said. And to me, the question is, how much of a glutton for punishment were these people? I mean, he called them hypocrites time after time and made them look like fools. And if you think that was bad, where do we get to chapter 23 where he really reads their titles clear with all the woes that he pronounces on them? And I'm thinking, you know, as malicious, where he says that he perceived the malice, as malicious as these people are, how much of this can they take? Well, not much, because they crucified him. Jimmy?
I'm going to indict myself here, but the other thing that stands out in these responses he gives, and not just here but elsewhere, he says so little. I mean, he chooses to say so little, and other times he remains silent. Obviously, there's times where I'm sure he'd like to say a lot of things, but silence was the way to go. But he says so little and says so much. So many times we say so much and say so little.
Yeah.
We could take a page out of the master teacher's book about at times, considering your audience, you really need to go into the small. Is it going to get you anywhere? So I'm not saying very little is
pithy. Somebody else have a hand? Okay. Thank you very much for your comments. It's always better when the group comments, and we'll take up with what the Sadducees pull on him next week.